Welcome to Care in Action, the podcast by Care Austria, with Andrea Barstorff-Hager.
A warm welcome to our Care in Action podcast. Today, I have a very special guest from the United Nations, Ramesh Rajasingham. A very warm welcome to Care Austria. Ramesh Rajasingham is the Acting Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Director of Coordination Division and the OCHA representative in Geneva. With decades of experience in global humanitarian operations, he has led responses to major crises, including disaster preparedness missions and evaluations of collective aid efforts. Born in Sri Lanka, Ramesh brings a deeply personal perspective shaped by his own experience in conflict zones, making him a passionate advocate for equitable aid in overlooked regions. So Ramesh, I think for our audience, it is very clear why you are my guest. And this is also at the occasion of the release of the 10th edition of the Forgotten Crisis Report, which is produced in cooperation with Care Germany and Care Austria on behalf of Care International. And as Care is working under UN mandate, I think it is very clear to our audience why you are our guest today. And maybe just to get us started, to kick it off, you could share with us what motivated you, what was a special moment in your early life or maybe in your career already that put you into humanitarian coordination?
Sure. Thanks very much, Andre. It's a real pleasure for me to be here with you as well and to discuss these issues that I think that are going to have quite an impact on the humanitarian sector in the coming period. I can't really point to one particular issue that really led me to this. I think, you know, I've always wanted to be in this field, and I will have to search my memory deep to see what triggered it. One of the things that inspired me to do this was I was teaching English to Afghan refugees many years ago, soon after they crossed the border into Pakistan in 1982. And I think in that experience, you know, I was very inspired to do this sort of work. And then when the Afghanistan operation opened 10 years later for OCHA, it was a precursor to OCHA, I put my hand up. And at that time in 1989, no one wanted to go to Afghanistan. And I was fortunate to be able to, that I was selected to go there. We had a very small office. And it was that experience that really led me to this. And as you said, you know, I've worked in many other crisis countries since then. And each one is different. But, you know, the pain that everyone goes through and what you witness, you know, it cannot be compared. These are people who live in terrible situations, horrible situations, find the wherewithal to survive and to help each other. They really are an inspiring crowd, the affected population. So inspiration upon inspiration kept me in the job. It does have its challenges, for sure, and we're having a big one now. But I'm very glad I chose this path.
So I have mentioned it in the introduction already that Care Austria, on behalf of Care International, will release the 10th edition of the so-called Forgotten Crisis Report. When you hear Forgotten crisis, what comes immediately to your mind, Ramesh?
First of all, congratulations to CARE. I think, you know, in releasing that report, you are shining a light on something that is invisible to most of the world. You know, of course, you have Gaza, which is on your front, on the headlines and on your television sets. You have Sudan as well, which is increasingly there as well. But there are many crises where people are in equally desperate situations, where they fear for their lives, where mothers are worried whether their children will be sitting at the dinner table that night, if they do have a dinner table, if they do have shelter, because of all the violence that goes on, gender-based violence. All these things take place in other crises as well, not the ones that you see on your screens on a daily basis. And when there's no attention paid to them, there are very few resources coming to them. So what you are doing is you're doing an excellent job in highlighting those issues to try and raise attention, to raise resources, to raise political action, which is also most important, to bring your voice to the voices, basically, because that's really what happens. You lose your voice when you're in a forgotten crisis.
Because there is, without doubt, a clear connection between media attention on a crisis and allocation of resources. We have really evidence for that. And of course, you can use different parameters to do such a forgotten crisis report. We know that the European Union, they also have a report on a forgotten crisis, and they have their own budget line for those. But CARE has been focusing on the media attention because we know there is a direct connection to attention and also private donations, which are also key for emergencies, especially in the long run. I have to admit that the title per se is something that makes me sad, that we are talking, we have to talk about millions of people that are somehow forgotten, struggling for survival. To make it very clear, these underreported emergencies affect nearly 35 million people, which is really a very high number. And I think that you have seen the list, which is embargoed until the release of the report, of course, but we can talk about it. Is there something on the list that surprises you? Because the top three, if you want, the most underreported crisis is Central African Republic, followed by Namibia, Zambia, Malawi, Honduras, North Korea, Angola, Burundi, Zimbabwe, and Madagascar. Is there something that surprised you, or is that what you expected, more or less?
No, I think certainly you could add to that list. Nothing really surprises me in that list. What we are seeing today is there's an absence of adequate political and development action has led to a protracted nature in many crises. So while conflict is a trigger for displacement, for increased vulnerability, severity of needs, humanitarians are basically your first aid responders, right? They are there to provide short-term, rapid life-saving assistance. But that is not a sustainable operation. So many of the countries referred to have slipped off the conflict scale. They're no longer in conflict. Or the disaster that led to that, those needs is over. But it's become a protracted crisis because there's been no one to pick up the pieces and to help those populations develop, progress, provide livelihoods so that they can support themselves. And so, there's nothing there that surprises me. And I think we're seeing a trend in the world today in the scarcity of strong development action and political action to pick up those pieces when a disaster or a conflict is over and to help those communities rebuild.
I mean, protracted crises, protracted emergencies, it's not a new buzzword, but this is the common practice, I would say, as you mentioned, when emergency hits. And the main reason for it, that we have different layers of complexity all happening at the same time. And when you then slip from the public attention list, as you called it, then the probability that somebody comes around picking up the pieces gets less and less, because people simply don't know what is going on in many places we are working. And the challenge for the multilaterals and also large institutions like CARE is that you need ongoing funding for protracted crises, but the emergency phase is relatively short, and what happens afterwards is not of so much interest neither, and this is not offending, but neither for the media, because they can't go on reporting from all the crises in the world. They would have nothing else on their platforms anymore, nor for the public, because people can't stay alert all the time. I think it is a quite interesting phenomena, and I had a discussion with many outsiders from care, because we are all in our sector bubble somehow, that we saw the cyclone in South Asia very recently, right? And when I started in this sector, I would have said this would have been a major emergency and would have a lot of public attention, in spite of the fact that many people I have talked to have practically self-experience, because in many countries that are affected now, many people from the richer industrialized countries have been, and some of them many times, but still, that this is a major, major emergency outside of the sector is not so much perceived anymore like that. Do you see it similarly?
I think you're right. I think you're right there, Andrea. There's so many crises erupting. There's an accumulation of crisis because there's no solutions for the older ones. So there's a growing need of people who are in these situations. And as you said, the media cannot cover them all because it loses they lose their sort of market interest. And climate change is going to make it worse. I think we're seeing conflict is now the biggest driver of displacement, but I suspect that, you know, in a few years' time, unless the trends that we are seeing is unchecked, you know, we're going to see an ever-expanding number of climate-related disasters. And this will just further isolate those ones that, you know, that have no interest for the media. And I think that's very important notice. I was actually in Sri Lanka during the cyclone at the end of November, and I saw the devastating effect. Sri Lanka's already emerging out of a very difficult economic situation after, that comes 15 years after a horrendous civil war. And there are very little resources right now to support this. So I think it's important to come to support these disasters, because otherwise they will become a longer-term burden. And also I think at the same time, it's important for the governments of the countries that are affected to take a much stronger stand on this as well. So I think in many cases, a lot has to fall on the responsibility of the shoulders of the government that's overseeing this, and how do we come in to support them behind their leadership in these disasters?
So you can understand this also as an invitation, if you can, to donate to CARE and the large institutions who are working in Sri Lanka. As a matter of fact, CARE Austria has a very close relationship with our affiliate organization, Chrysalis, in Sri Lanka, and we have already provided funding for the emergency phase. And I can say here that we also already are settling a contract for providing funding in the longer term, which is also desperately needed, because the public attention and interest fades very quickly. You can say after 1 week, 10 days maximum, it is gone. So the emergency phase is a few weeks, and then you have to do all the recovery work, where we also will be involved, especially in Sri Lanka, but as CARE, of course, in all the other areas, as well. Let's talk a little bit about, because my colleague in Sri Lanka said, besides shelter and water and all the things that are needed first, warm food is something that is really key and has to be provided very quickly. Let's talk a moment about the phenomena that hunger is not only back on stage. We see increasing numbers. And you said that in many cases nowadays, the food shortage is not only stemming from environmental impacts, but also a significant sign of political crisis. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
No, definitely. I mean, I think just based on what you just said, thank you very much to CARE Austria for all that support for the crisis of the disaster that came out of the cyclone in Sri Lanka. It's great that you've been able to provide that support. I think it has also to be said, almost all the humanitarian crises we face has at its root a political issue. And I think, as I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, we are seeing less strong political and development action to support those crises, which could actually then roll back the vulnerability and help people support themselves. Hunger and famine, yes, very much it's very much linked to political issues, both in the countries where it happens, because there's a lack of adequate political attention, political action in those countries. But also it relates to, how do we promote livelihoods in those countries so that they can support themselves? We're seeing famine and hunger in Sudan. We're seeing it in Gaza. We're seeing it in Somalia, in many parts of the Sahel. And there are actions that can be taken that can, political action that can be taken that can actually not just stop it, not just to mitigate it, but actually stop it. And that goes to, allowing access for food to those affected areas, allowing those countries to access markets so that they can find food that can supplement the needs for their populations at a lower cost, etc. What we have done in OCHA is we've looked beyond the crisis in the past to see what we can do to address this. So a good example of this, for example, was the issue of the Black Sea grain deal that we brokered together with Turkey's help, Turkey's help, with Moscow and Ukraine and other actors, to allow for Ukrainian wheat and food commodities to find a channel to be exported. And that had an impact, not just in food going directly to a country, but it had an impact in that you are increasing the availability of food in the market in general, the global market. And when that happens, you will see a reduction in prices. And when you see a reduction in prices, it makes food much more affordable. And if food is more affordable, then more families can be supported with less resources. So we recognize that there are things that you can do, and we're looking to see how we can do this beyond a very specific crisis as well.
Would you say, because listening, and of course I know these things and I remember well, when the food crisis increased due to the war in Ukraine, but this could lead us to jump very quickly to the conclusion that many of the things and the humanitarian phenomena that we see are man-made. Would you agree to that?
Yes, without a doubt. As I said, most of the crises that you will see on our Global Humanitarian Overview, which is launched on Monday, they all have a very strong element where there are man-made issues that led to them, that triggered them, man-made issues that protracted them, and a lack of, I would say, man-made solutions to resolve them.
So maybe this is a very naive question after 30 years in humanitarian work, but man-made sounds to me like this should be solvable easily than if it would be other reasons, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that, political will is something that is missing in many of these crises. And the question is, how do you change political will in these situations? And increasingly we're seeing a lack of respect for international humanitarian law. We are seeing in many ways a collapse of the international rules-based system. So many of the principles that we operate with, they're less and less respected. Aid workers are increasingly targeted. In the last 2 years, we've seen the highest number by far of aid workers directly targeted as well, but also falling casualty in conflict. So yes, and I think that's at the root of it all. It's this lack of respect for international law, lack of compliance with international law. Now, IHL has never really had a good year per se. There's always, wherever you had wars, you had major IHL violations.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're seeing today is a loss of respect or an unequal application of international law throughout the world. And this is a very worrying thing for us, because the moment you have that unequal application, you open the door for much more impunity.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a phenomena, a very harmful phenomena that we also see and feel in our own roles. But what would you identify? Because this is something that didn't happen overnight. This is a development that we have seen, I would say, throughout the last decade, maybe evolve in a way that all of us would not have expected. What may be the root cause that people tend to ignore the importance of international humanitarian law? Is it that for many of us, 80 years ago is too far ago, that we appreciate and protect humanitarian law, because simply we don't have any practice, that many of us have forgotten how much it is needed and how much access, humanitarian access and respect is needed in order to deliver humanitarian aid? Might that be a reason?
It's a very good point, Andrea. I think 80 years is indeed a long time ago. It's several generations ago. So you have generations today that they have not experienced what the world went through 80 years ago. I think we've seen an emergence of nations as well after the colonial, in the post-colonial world after that. I think we've seen increasing demands and needs, right? The crux of all this is humanity and the understanding that when you have a crisis in one part of the world, it has an impact which you may not necessarily see immediately on the rest of the globe. And I think this is what we fail to understand, that, you know, when you see someone in a situation that you certainly would not want to be in on the other side of the world, that immediate need to provide principles, strong, effective assistance and support to that population is not there as it used to be. And I think we have to go back to this understanding of humanity. Whenever one part of humanity is affected, it affects all of humanity. And I think that's what's probably missing from the period 80 years ago, when we came out of a devastating crisis and it was easy to witness it firsthand almost, right? It was right in front of you. Today, I think going back to what we said earlier, is that there are so many crises, such a spread of crisis that, you can't cover them all. So it's difficult to understand how this has an impact on you. But, I think there are many factors leading to this, but I think, humanity has to be the one that we really want to raise a flag of and show how this impacts all our lives in the long run.
I mean, for the situation that we see and at the moment, and we come to that, we are even talking about the humanitarian reset, which is mainly driven by the fact that resources get very scarce for all the protagonists around. At the moment, we have 380 million people in desperate need for humanitarian aid. So what really, after 30 years in the sector, also comes to my mind, and I would be interested to hear your take on it. Did our institutions, did all of us do enough to engage the public audience and keep them engaged? Or are we at the same time maybe too much focused on our direct delivery, implementation, resource mobilization, and I don't know what, so that the public outside, including many public institutions, forgot about the importance of what we are talking about at the moment? Did we do our job good enough? Looking at the situation now that we have to defend the humanitarian system, that we really have to struggle to mobilize resources. So I see it from a part, I see it also on our side, that we have to communicate more offensive and less defensive about what we are doing and how important it is. Because we should not forget, the world has never been that much interconnected than these days, right?
You're absolutely right. So there's no no humanitarian should be defensive about those challenges that we face internally to deliver effective assistance, etc. And you're right. There is, you know, we have, based on what we have now, we are underfunded, we are under pressure, we're under attack, as Under Secretary General Tom Pletcher has said on numerous occasions. And he has witnessed this in his numerous travels to affected situations. We are under pressure, enormous pressure. And indeed, we could, and we are looking to reset the systems so that we can do this this work much more effectively. As such, what must be said though is that humanitarian assistance over the years, thanks to the generosity of donors, donors mainly in Europe, in Japan, in North America, etc., and in the Gulf countries, we've managed to save millions of lives with assistance. And we do it in situations where you have no rule of law. We have little security, little protection, where all your normal infrastructure does not work. So our colleagues, especially our local NGO actors, are on the front line in crises, taking enormous risk to provide assistance. No one else can do that. So yes, we certainly are, there's a lot that we can do that can be done better in the future. In the future, we are on it, and I'll speak to that. But we must not take away the fact that had these actors not been on the ground, on the front line, providing assistance, we would have seen a much, much bigger number of people, a much, much higher mortality rate, many, many more people affected by crisis with no hope to assistance. So I think we have to lay that on the ground there. And we've done it with minimal resources because, it sounds bigger. We're appealing for $33 billion to assist 135 million people in 2026. But that's a priority figure. You know, it's actually, as you said, it's 300 million people who are in need, but we are now prioritizing it to the most vulnerable because of a lack of resources. But even that, even if you were to double the 33 billion, it's still a small fraction of what, as our Secretary General said, that the globe spends on defense and military and conflict, right? It really would not make a big difference, a big dent to support that. But somehow the focus has been on us as opposed to on solutions. And humanitarians are not the solution. We really are just there to provide temporary life-saving assistance until there's a solution to the situation. So that's important to say. Now, just going on to the reset, yes, so Tom Pletcher has launched, together with the Interagency Standing Committee, which is the Standing Committee of UN humanitarian agencies plus NGOs and the Red Crescent Movement, the Humanitarian Reset. And this is supposed to focus on four key issues where we can do better and how do we do it better. We call them the four Ds, basically. The first one is to define the work we do. How do we go back to our roots and prioritize those populations that are specifically affected by a humanitarian crisis? We are not there to address populations in abject poverty because of economic collapse or failure. We're there for those drivers of humanitarian crisis, conflict, disaster, massive health pandemics.
So the basics of emergency work.
That's right. Exactly. Going back to our roots, as it were. The second one is, the second D is deliver. How do we deliver more effectively? And this is looking at our processes. You know, in any organization, you have processes that develop and accumulate, and they lead to, in many ways, time-consuming activities. How do we streamline those processes so that we are much more agile and flexible when it comes to addressing these extraordinary crises? The third D is to devolve. And this is our biggest challenge. And it's going to be the crux of the issue. How do we devolve the leadership of our activities to those on the ground who should be working hand in glove with local actors, specific local actors and local populations who are affected, to identify what they need most and to provide that assistance. So have the local populations and the local actors drive that decision-making process to define what they need most, not what we think they need the most. This means local women-led organizations, affected groups of women and children, displaced communities, and people who are under threat. Have them tell us what they really need, and then let that drive that. And the fourth one, sorry, Andres, fourth D is defend. And this goes back to what I said before about the loss of respect for international law, the rules-based system. How do we regain that sense of neutrality and those humanitarian principles that we had, 25 years ago?
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to add that to the third D, to the devolve, that I'm, of course, part of the discussion, and it's somehow always overwhelming that it is still such a discussion that deliverance and all activities related to emergencies and also to the so-called development work should be led by local actors, which is something quite natural in the case of care, to be honest, because we do a lot of we don't deliver ourselves a lot anymore. This is the smaller part of our activities. And the first responders, no matter what happens, are always the people on the ground.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is really something where I would say, okay, we have to admit that we are always those who come later than the ones that are on the ground, which is a natural thing. And it is more about channeling funding and providing assistance when needed, but the key steps have to be taken by local organizations and local protagonists. And the 4D, the defend, is really a pity that we have to defend humanitarian aid and humanitarian action. It should be in the DNA of every human being. You mentioned Tom Fletcher twice, and I would like to ask you, do you think, because he has mentioned that in the two meetings I had with him, do you see a potential in the new technologies that these make our emergency work, could make our emergency interventions more effective? Do you see that?
No, most definitely. I think new technologies is going to be critical in our work as we go forward. I think there's enormous opportunities which we have to avail ourselves of to be able to make our work much more effective. And through the UNAIDS process as well, now what we're seeing, what we are targeting or what we'd like to do is to make sure that all those UN organizations involved in humanitarian response pool their resources, pool their systems to streamline them. So you have, single systems in terms of supply chains, what we call back office functions, the whole procurement of procurement and administrative tasks behind the work that we do, which is enormous, by the way, logistics, etc. Yeah. This is where new technologies, relating to data systems, etc., can have enormous impact. And this is what we're working on today as well. So I'm very sure that in this coming in the new year, in 2026. You will see significant strides along that route for us.
Very good. I'm looking forward to that. And let me mention that Care Austria is hosting an international meeting of the Steering Committee on Humanitarian Response in January in Vienna, where we will discuss exactly the 4Ds and how we can join forces better. How we can join forces better to be more effective and more efficient. Yeah, to close our interesting conversation, Ramesh, you witnessed so much. You're so experienced. So what keeps you going? I want to end on a positive note.
I had to go back to what I said at the beginning. What's kept me going in this job has been moments of inspiration following moments of inspiration. And that has primarily come from the populations who are in these situations. You know, what they've done to survive, how they have put away all, everything else to focus on supporting their community, their families. And I think that has really inspired me, because I think that is the essence of humanity, right? When all the chips are down, you know, this is what you want to focus on, helping each other. And they actually give me inspiration. So it's a bit of a strange thing. It's these affected populations who are actually helping me. They help me understand what is humanity. They help me better understand my job. They help me better understand how I can be useful. And they inspire me with their courage and bravery in the face of unimaginable threats and risks and violence. So I think that's what really keeps me going. If they can keep going generation after generation in those situations, you know, certainly I can keep going in this privileged position that I have.
I think this is a wonderful closing comment to our conversation at the occasion of the release of the 10th edition of the Forgotten Crisis Report. So dear listeners, follow the suggestion of today's guest. Let yourself be inspired by the essence of humanity, and helping is always in fashion, not only at Christmas or at the end of the year. Ramesh Rajasingham, you were a wonderful guest to the Care in Action podcast. My heartfelt thank you to you. I'm looking forward to joining forces with all the institutions involved, and I do wish you all the best.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here, and thank you for all the support from Care Austria, and we wish you all the very best in this partnership that we will all have in this course. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Ramesh.
Thank you for listening. This was Care in Action, the podcast by Care Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager. For more information about Care and our projects, visit care.at. There you'll also find out how you can support our work. This podcast is made possible with the generous support of CC Real. Thank you for your commitment, which enables this series of conversations. See you next time.